All right, I have joining the podcast today a guy that I've been wanting to have on the podcast for quite a while. He has a new album out that we'll talk about, and he's been part of some other bands such as Man at the World, but I have Randy Rose joining. Randy, thanks for joining the podcast.
Happy to be here, buddy. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great, man. I know this was kind of thrown together pretty quickly, but I feel like I'm pretty prepared to ask you some stuff just because I have been a fan of Rose and Man at the World. And
awesome.
I do have some questions, I've always wondered, so I get to ask you now.
Yeah, absolutely.
But of course, going back, I have to ask the typical kind of thing with all my artists or people that come on, my guests, but what was your early influences musically? Because I mean, if people listen to your stuff, either Man at the World, you guys were kind of all over the place at times, not
absolutely.
Really bad, crazy, but you sure. Guys were, you had different formats at times, so I'm kind of curious what your influences were at an early age.
Okay, if I have to start from the beginning, I was inspired by the whole Christian music scene in Orange County through Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. That's where they had the rock concerts every Saturday night. Chuck Smith had them out there. I was born in 71, so I caught it a little bit later. I wasn't quite in the full Jesus People movement, but it's still when they're doing that big music ministry out there, so... I got to see bands like the Archers and Sweet Comfort and all the old bands, that my brothers used to do. There's a 13-year difference between me and my brothers. So I was a baby. So, kind of whatever they listened to, that was my thing. So as I was hearing Sweet Comfort, as a young kid and the Archers, and then later on, I was a huge fan of Undercover and the Altar Boys when they came out, that was my big thing. That's when I really realized I wanted to do Christian music. But I mean, my brother listened to Kansas and Black Sabbath, all that crazy kind of stuff. So as an early kid, I mean, I was exposed to a ton of music, But my first interest, as far as having an interest in wanting to do music, was like by seeing Undercover and some of the Association of the Cross and the punk and alternative bands in the late 70s, early 80s, when I was still in elementary school, actually. I'd take my friends to those concerts, and a lot of them would get saved. It was wonderful.
Is Roger, do you have other brothers, or is Roger?
I have Roger, who's the middle brother, who's 13 years younger, and then Ray Rose, who's done a lot of studio work on my albums. And Roger,
okay,
and Matt Rose, Ray Rose, he did a lot of bass work. He's played with Crossroads, a bunch of TBN and stuff like that, but he wasn't really too much into the rock stuff. He was much more mature than we and Roger are or were,
Yeah, so I was going to ask you that too about the age gap there with you and Roger, since you guys obviously did a lot of music together and still do music together, but so it's 13 years.
Definitely.
And then was Roger kind of the first one involved, or your older brother involved in music? And when did you kind of, did that influence you to become a musician or sing or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. We grew up in Orange County, and my dad, from my brothers and myself, when I was a little tiny kid, built us it started out as a practice room, a facility just to practice our music, drums, guitars, not to, explode the whole house full of music and, interrupt guests and whatnot. But he built this little recording studio, a place to record. And then my brothers, through high school, were totally into, Rush and Black Sabbath, just all the stuff that was in the 70s. So they were playing, and they were just little different garage bands, but not in a garage, in a little recording facility. Right. I saw that at an early age, of course, just loved it. And Roger taught me how to play drums when I was like 5 or 6 years old,
As a drummer? Because I know he's a great played drummer. On albums too. So
yeah, he's a great drummer, but I definitely have passed him up. I'm kidding. No, I'm definitely not kidding. He's a great drummer, and he still is a great drummer. But he taught me everything, and then I was I was really influenced by Gary Olson, from Undercover. Yeah. He was kind of my idol that I'm not supposed to have as a drummer. Such a pumping drummer. I mean, I was a teenager, young teenager when I saw him, but I loved him. Still love him.
I had Gary on the show not too long ago.
I saw him on your list. That was cool. Yeah.
And of course, the first thing we start talking about was, because I play drums too, and we're like, first 20 minutes was just drum talk.
Oh yeah. Oh man.
And I'm sure people that are not drummers were like, who cares? Can you move on to something else?
Get on to the music.
Who cares about the drum head
he's using?
But so really drums were the first thing that you kind of picked up.
Yeah. Yep. And then Roger also taught me guitar shortly thereafter. And I started like writing and playing drums and in a little tiny 4-track studio. I was just out of, I don't know, I think it was just barely going into middle school when I was already starting to record and write my own stuff. I mean, it kind of happened at a really early age, and And of course, I was writing everything that I was kind of hearing around me. So everything was just kind of just edgy or rock and roll or pseudo goth, you know, starting when I started getting a little bit older, kind of getting into that kind of stuff, you know, the Sisters of Mercy and all the crazy stuff like that, you know. But I was a kind of a singer songwriter from the early age. Even on a, we had a band before, and there's no records of it. I just found actually a cassette of a demo. But me, Roger, Ray, and Mike were, and Mike Pendleton was one of the early three of Mad at the World.
Yeah.
He's a good guy too. We kind of all grew up together. They kind of like lived at our house half the time and stuff like that. But we were in a band called Saved. Just a,
okay.
You know, a stereotypical name for a early Christian band. But you know, that's where we were before we were Mad at the World. And then we realized, you know, KROQ was breaking all this British stuff. You know, we're KROQ. You're familiar with KROQ? The radio station in California?
They call it K-Rock or?
K-Rock, yes.
Yeah,
K-Rock,
yeah, yeah. I've heard that, yeah.
Well, it was kind of like how they say, you know, California sets the tone and the world follows type of thing. Well,
right.
In the music industry during the 80s and late 70s, you know, England was the thing to be, you know, it was where the Smiths were from, it was where Depeche Mode was from, it was where the alternative movement was kind of born. And K-Rock would always break that stuff real early. Like they broke Oingo Boingo real early. That's kind of where they got heard in that area. So we were exposed to a lot of stuff that a lot of different states didn't hear, you know. I mean, I don't mean that arrogantly. It was a radio station. I'm nothing. I was just hearing it, you know. But they were playing some stuff that was really kind of crazy and different for the time. And I think that's what, you know, Krumbacher, you know, kind of caught on that, you know, realized that there's synth music, you know, and we could do Christian synth music and have an alternative to having to listen to, you know, Kraftwerk or Depeche Mode. But, you know, we were definitely in the early album influenced from everybody from the Cult to the Smiths, heavily Depeche Mode, very heavily Depeche Mode. You know, saw them a couple times in concert. The Pet Shop Boys, a band called Style. I mean, it was, you know, a lot of Euro synth type pop stuff, you know. But yeah, you know, we still had kind of those backbones of rock and roll, you know. Like I said, my brother used to Black Sabbath and whatnot, so that kind of like Love, Light and Midnight and stuff like that, or Dancing on Your Grave, you know, that was on the first couple albums. That was still some more rock and roll stuff. Like you said, we were pretty schizophrenic when it came to the music, you know. We played what we loved and what we liked, you know, ultimately.
Well, I was introduced to you guys like in the middle there. So when you guys were doing the rock stuff and then.
Okay. Yeah. Seasons of Love on Out.
I didn't have access to the old stuff. So until I was like, whoa, it's a whole different sound. When you guys were the band Saved, was that, were you doing the synth pop stuff then? Or was that,
it was
something you transitioned to?
We were literally ripping off Undercover the best we could.
Okay.
Literally. My brother. No, I'm serious. I have no shame in admitting it because I loved Undercover. I loved it.
Yeah.
My brother Roger actually played bass on a synth bass, same kind of bass that they use, you know, and keyboards. So my brother was playing bass and keyboards at the same time and singing. I was on drums and we had guitar. So just a three piece. I mean, it was literally almost like Undercover, but it was heavily influenced by that, you know, just live drums with synth bass. And it was kind of a rocky new age, like an edgy new wave kind of thing, but not definitely not synth pop, because we didn't go to that stuff until we, you know, started going with Frontline Music and started getting into Depeche Mode. And then we started getting into the computers and sequencing and sampling and all that crazy stuff, you know.
Well, I don't know what's true. You know, you read stuff on online, so you're not really sure what's true or not, of course. But
sure.
I know that one of the things said that obviously you kind of confirmed this, though. You guys already had a studio, had a lot of equipment. And is it true that, I guess, as Mad at the World, or I don't know if you were Mad at the World at that point, but that Roger just happened to put a cassette tape of your stuff with Frontline and just kind of dropped it off? And that's how that started that connection?
Yeah, I'll give you the full story if you want that one.
Of course.
Roger is and still is to this day a mailman. He's been doing it for years. He just loves being outdoors and loves doing it. Jimmy Kempner, you know, the owner of Frontline Records, was on his route. So, you know, we're in his band seeing all these cool Frontline artists, you know, that we would go and see at Maranatha Music, you know, which is at Calvary Chapel's music store. They had a record store. We just loved going there. It was just like, it was our Tower Records, you know, for Christians, because, you know, in that day and age, we try to go there first and then we run out of Christian artists and we have to go to the world, you know. Kidding, kind of, but we'd go there and see and hear all these cool artists, you know, like on a Saturday night, you know, rock show where they play alternative music, and realize, man, these are all Frontline Records, and Jimmy Kimmer's the owner of it, you know, and hey, we're doing music, you know. So we made a demo. Basically, it was almost exactly like the very first Mad at the World album, very synth pop, you know, all that kind of stuff, kind of like an Oingo Boingo synth. It's our first album. Go back and listen to it, and you'll know what I'm saying. But he was on the route. We recorded the demo, and he was going to drop it off there. and I don't think he'll be embarrassed me telling it. He was actually like kind of like chicken out. He was almost kind of ashamed because for such a talented guy and for such a bold guy as far as his music, he was real shy about presenting it, you know. And I was just, you know, I was nice and dumb and kiddish, you know. I was still so young. I was 13, 14 years old, so I had no shame of that. So what I did, I put the cassette that he was too ashamed to play in our, you know, in our little PA, cranked up real loud. I said, Rod, just picture you're haven't heard this kind of music, you know, especially in Christian music, and your record label, and just tell me if you'd be interested. I pushed play, and I said, just forget this yourself. Just listen to the music. You know, is it cool? Is it different? Is it unique? You know. And he goes, oh, you're right, it is cool. So he got the nerve and popped it in there, and we were considering moving to the high desert at that point. We lived in Orange County, and we were on a trip. No more than a week after that, we got a call, and they literally said, we're super interested in your demo. We want to meet you. And we were signed within like a week or two. It was, I mean, complete miracle of God, complete dream come true. I give take absolutely no credit for it, completely the Lord just giving us, you know, my personal dream. You know, that's what I always wanted to do.
The when you guys do sign, you do the first is the self-titled, correct? And
With the
was that
gold.
around 86 or so, 85, 86? But did you guys have most of those songs written at that time? Because it looks like,
We
I mean, I know you did re-releases, but there's 12 songs that I see on the album.
they were all literally recorded and ready to go. I don't think we wrote anything for it. We just literally resequenced it at the green room, and then we did a couple tracks, actually, I think a couple tracks at our place. You know, we took our computers and sequencers into a green room, which is a studio that,
Yeah.
you know, a whole bunch of people did in Orange County.
And that's
Almost
what was
all of them.
released, basically.
And that was, I mean, we all recorded all the new vocals and stuff like that, but that's absolutely what was released. So what was on the demo, we just redid it all on, you know, big fat 2-inch analog, redid all the vocals there. We kind of mixed it with them there and produced it there and manufactured, and they manufactured it, and that was our first release. Yeah.
How old were you during that time, that first album? You said you're
13 to 14.
13.
Yeah, turning in
That
14.
it, was that an issue for the record label? Did they ever address it or say,
Oh
man, this guy's
no.
pretty young?
No, because me and Krista Lewis were both were she was only
Right.
about like 6 or 7 months of my age, either the exact same age or real close to it. She was 15 or 16 too, I think. You know, and she was signed to Frontline. So no, they didn't, there was no release of liability. You know, I mean, I am not mad at the world. I was just a big part of it. It's me and my brother. You know, he wrote the first part of the stuff. He wrote almost all that stuff. And I was just, you know, I was just there for vocals and the sequencing of stuff. And then I became a much greater part about it later, you know. But we did it together.
How was that for you as, I mean, being so young and still in school? Or did you finish school, or did you were you
Oh,
I asked the same thing to but well, I was gonna did you get to finish school because or was mo music a priority? How are you like kind of mixing that together in
Well,
life?
luck. It was real easy for me because I was so horrible at school that pretty much just I'm pretty much missing school when I went to school. I'm kidding.
Yeah,
No,
I know, same way. High
I'm
school.
kidding. No, I it, yeah, high school was rough for me, but no, it wasn't an issue because, I mean, keep back in that time, the Christian music scene, the only concerts were to play would be, you know, on Saturday nights, Christmas Eve, Halloween night, and then Christian festivals that you'd fly out for. So there really was nothing that, you know, that I couldn't miss or have my mom write me a note at school for, you know. So I mean, I think I was a sophomore, you know. So I mean, I still had a couple years of school, you know, when we were
I mean,
signed, you
that's
know.
pretty cool though. You can present to your fellow students like, hey, here's an album
Actually, I'll, you
we're
know,
on a
actually,
label.
I'll, you know, we were a freshman when I signed, actually. So I went through all 4 years of it. But it was wonderful. I loved it because, you know, I was kind of shy. I always dressed crazy. Once I saw, you know, the Christian punk scene, you know, I spiked my hair and had, you know, the weird cutoff jackets and pins, safety pins, and my hair was spiked and stuff. So I wore my dad's like seriously super huge combat boots. They weren't even designed for a kid. I'd sneak them on, and I had a separate set of clothes that I keep at my friend's house because my poor sweet protective dad didn't want me getting beat up, you know.
All right.
But it happened anyways. I got beat up in high school, Nia, big
Oh
time.
man. I'm kind of curious then, were you ever involved in anything musically at that point, or was it just strictly Mad at the World during that time also?
It was only Mad at the World, and then I just wrote, kind of always kept writing in my own private den, and then, you know, usually I just get those songs up to Raj, and they become Mad at the World songs. So yeah, it was only Mad at the World until I decided to do, you know, Rose, you know.
Yeah. Well, and another question I always kind of wondered was, because you would usually be on one or two tracks or so for the matter of, eventually you started your stuff in there. Was that, how was that, I guess, decided that, okay, you'll have your one or two tracks, or were those like the songs that you actually wrote, or how'd you kind of come to that decision as a band, since Roger was the lead vocalist usually?
Well, I can even back that up a little bit to give you some foundation of it. The early Mad at the World stuff that we did, you know, that was sequenced, very computer, the stuff that you're not too familiar with or whatever, you know. It's, you know, it's like a lot of people today that have them, you know, on tracks. Literally, a whole bunch of stuff is sequenced on tracks. So I'd play triggers live and some acoustic drum stuff, you know, not because the real cymbals. There'd be a real guitar player and real vocals, but I mean everything is sequenced on computer like Depeche Mode was. That became so awkward to play live that we wanted to go like, you know what, let's see what it's like to put me back on a drum kit and start writing songs that, you know, enable us to transition to possibly a more of a live band. You know what I'm saying? So that's kind of where the influence of the Cult, you know, Cult Electric was a big influence kind of on Mad at the World and huge influence on me, as you can tell in some of the music, you know, in the Doors and all that kind of stuff. So the actual awkwardness of playing as a three-piece playing digital music, needing to play a live band, actually feel like you're in control of the music. That was one of the things that decided us to help us be more of a live band and more moving towards a rock or alternative rock movement. And that's what opened the door for me, because I was a natural, you know, rocker guy. I'm the guy that had that screaming Jim Morrison voice or whatever, you know. And so it was just kind of natural to start kind of doing that stuff and taking a little more of a role with those couple songs. And pretty soon those couple songs turned into, you know, after two or three albums, where it was half, you know, the last probably third of the set would be my stuff. Roger would go back to the drums, I would go to the front, and I would be kind of like the quote unquote like encore, the whole all the, you know, Dancing on Your Grave, that song, you know, Drugs Only Kill You song, you know, all the rough stuff. Marshmallow Land, you know, which we used to do in Mad at the World too, you know. We did row songs too, some of those. So yeah, so I kind of finished that out. So really it was all about just, we really wanted to present ourselves as a, you know, a legitimate live band. And the only way to do that is to step out from the computers and play the instruments. And we just couldn't do that unless the music kind of changed with us. So that kind of forced us to start doing that kind of rock and roll sound. And that enabled me to write more and have more input on it.
And that was basically after the first couple albums. Then you guys went with Seasons of Love, was kind of really around 90, was real the kind of bigger change into that rock sound. Well, how was the reaction from people that were already following you, that you guys made that change musically?
Well, you know what? That was a good thing. And I think we were blessed because we were in Orange County during that time, and the Christian music scene was just so ridiculously supportive. I mean, everybody supported each other. We went to all of our concerts. All the bands went to each other's concerts. You know, we'd go see LSU. People from LSU we would see in the crowds. Fans of LSU would go to see us. You know, it's just the way it was, you know, because it was just a big melting pot. There's so many bands were from Orange County during that time, you know. So it was just a big thing of support. So basically, if we would do the Smith stuff, that's not too much of a stretch from any kind of electronica, because it's nice and wimpy and melodic and alternative, you know, and you know, kind of just introverted and dark, you know, whatever. So any of that stuff is it's a natural transition to go to anything that's kind of gothic, which is a little darker. If you go through anything that's gothic, then it's okay to cross genres and go to something that's edgy and gothic, like Sisters of Mercy or whatever. So the fans always had the same kind of taste we did, just because we're so such a conglomerate of a community of artists and fans, and honestly, the Christian youth groups just made this happen, really. I mean, they literally, we played so many youth group concerts. Undercover played at mine, Altar Boys played at mine, we played at several of them. It's just the way it was, man. I mean, I wish that never changed. I don't know why that changed. There still should be music happening for the youth. I feel so bad that they have to just starve themselves and go to a festival to see someone once or twice a year.
Yeah.
You know,
And
it's not right.
you guys didn't get to tour a lot, did you? Because I
No.
mean, like Roger had his full-time job, so you guys
No.
were
As
able to take a
yeah,
lot of time off.
no, yeah. As Mad at the World, I think it was when was it was during one huge riot or one war. We went on this one tour as Mad at the World. I mean, like a long, like month and a half tour in a van, actually just going everywhere. We played every Christian concert club there was. We played I think a couple different festivals and stuff out in the way, and it was nice. You know, it was definitely fun, but we were definitely excited to get back, because you know we were we were used to having our family and not being cooped up. We realized how strange people can be, you know, without any outlet of being normal, you know. I mean,
yeah,
the good thing is, you know, it was my brother and the other two people were our best friends. So we really got along good. It was just kind of fun. But, you know, I mean, I was 13, 14, 15 years old, you know, 16. Yeah,
you're pretty young.
Pretty young, yeah. Still. So, I mean, I'm a kid. So, it was super fun for me, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of get away from the parental stuff, maybe a little bit. Yeah, I got to experience that back in about the same age, too. It's fun. But it was different times back then, too, now. But
yeah, definitely, unfortunately.
And I was telling before we recorded that my introduction, the cassette tape I owned was Through the Forest, that album. And I mean, that album from top to bottom to me is just, there's nothing bad on it. I love every song on there. I used to listen to it all the time. You know, I have to pop side one out and flip it over for side two there. But
yeah, I think that's my favorite Mad at the World album, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that's a great, that's a really
strong good album.
It is, I agree. Another thing that you guys at the very end, you cover If I Can Dream. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I love the Elvis version, but you guys, Roger kind of does a little Elvis kind of vibe to it. But, yeah. I kind of want your thoughts or memories of making that album.
It was interesting. That was the time when the band was transitioning without Mike Pendleton. It was with Brent Gordon, who was also another childhood friend that kind of went along with us and kind of substituted guitar in. So it was our most rock album. It was the one that probably, I was already writing Sacrificium and I was already singing like Danzig. Far as I know, maybe even, I'm not positive, but I don't even remember when the first Rose album was released, but it was real close to around that time because Roger and my vocals were kind of both doing kind of a Danzig-y thing on some of the, you know, vocals. You can kind of even tell it, you can hear a little bit in Roger even, you know. So it was great making the album. That album was once again recorded. I think that was one of the last albums recorded in Irvine, California at the studio at the home, you know. Because that's basically all where we lived until we got married and moved out and stuff. You know, I moved up to the high desert because my parents have a house up here, which actually that's where I'm at right now. My father passed, so I'm here now. Yeah,
sorry to hear that.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's been a rough 3 years. There's been a lot of stuff happening, but God, you know, God is good still. But yeah, so that was the last album that we recorded kind of more like as a band thing. And then after that, it was a lot of just me and Roger doing it and then flying in the guitar player. So it wasn't so much us playing as a band. I mean, that's kind of the way a lot of albums are done now, where the band isn't in the same room. A lot of people write it, get the core tracks down, come in and lay vocals, have the lead guitar player come in, and the later albums were definitely more like that. So to me, from Through the Forest on back, were the ones where, you know, were a little more, we're all playing together, headphones on, I'm playing the drums with a rough guitar track and stuff like that. So I miss those days for sure, you know.
I didn't realize it. I correct me if I'm wrong, but on Dreamland Cafe, Roger played drums. You didn't play drums. Were you even involved in that album in any capacity or?
Not as much. That's the album that I probably had the least amount to do. I moved. He got married. He moved to a different house. I got married, moved to a different city, and we knew we wanted to do kind of a. We saw the band Jellyfish, and that.
That was exactly what I was going to ask you.
Yeah,
my note says it has a Jellyfish vibe.
Yeah, well,
was that intentional or not?
Oh, Jellyfish ruined and saved our life all at the same time. We saw Jellyfish at Magic Mountain. My wife, Roger, and sister-in-law saw them, and it was just ridiculous. It was the best thing I've ever, till this very day, mm-hmm. I've never seen a band more strong that could hit it that hard, that tight on vocals, super catchy, you know, super psychedelic, but cool, you know, just super cool. And it ruined us. I mean, it literally ruined us because, you know, we weren't Jellyfish.
But, yeah. I want to be them.
I totally wanted to be them. Yeah, and you heard that later on, and you know when I did some more of the psychedelic or more like Crazy Little World when I went off the wagon and did Crazy Little World and did that, you know, 60s style album, you know, this the third Rose album or whatever it was, you know.
Was that the one you have Mark Martel on, or is that one? That's later on.
Yeah, that was 3 years ago. That was okay. Songs for the Rich.
Of course, I want to ask you about that, but yeah Jellyfish, one of the greatest bands. A lot of people don't know about them because they only had the two albums, unfortunately.
Yep.
I mean, to me, and I've talked about Jellyfish on this podcast before with other people, but Andy Sturmer, man, what, I hate to say it this way, but what a waste of talent that he just doesn't do stuff like from since Jellyfish. I know he does cartoon music,
yeah,
Scooby, you know, Scooby-Doo or whatever, and occasionally I know he just came out with a new single, but
I don't get it. I honestly don't get it. I mean, I know what it's like to sit on talent and to be and to disobey God yeah. and act like you're not supposed to do that. I don't know what he feels like because it's, the gift is still from God. It still has to be burning inside of him. I know, Roger Joseph Manning, the keyboarder and the other singer, he's still continued. He's done his own stuff.
But, yeah. His stuff is great too.
His stuff is great, but together, you know, they had a little more of an edge to it. You know, when they all came together with Jason Faulkner and the guy they ended up saying for Slash's Snake Pit, you know, his name.
Yeah.
Is
Singer oh, I know Imperial. It. I know it.
He's a I'm Facebook going blank friend.
On sudden. Face, yeah.
Singer of Imperial Drag.
Yeah. For and I'm going blank, but I've actually had Tim Smith on. I had a different podcast,
he's awesome.
Yeah. I got to chat with him for my old podcast. It was a baseball related one, but I've more talked about because he's a Braves fan, but he lives in the Atlanta area near me now. But of course I talked to him mainly about Jellyfish, but I mean, that was just surreal. I got to ask him all the questions I've always wanted to know. Plus Jellyfish has a book. I don't know if you've read that book, but
no.
that was very interesting. That's a very interesting eye-opening book on, I guess it shows you kind of how their personalities are, Andy. But yeah, I mean, that was exactly what I was going to ask. I mean, I know you weren't involved in, but Dreamland Cafe, I heard it. I'm like, man, that sounds very Jellyfish influenced.
Yeah, it very much was. It and by the way, his name was Eric Dover.
Right, others, Eric Dover.
They were talking about
because they just had the licorice. What was it? The Licorice Quartet or
something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They put out a few albums. Those guys from Jellyfish without Andy.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's still good. Yeah,
very, that's very cool.
It's interesting that you guys were changing your sound, but going to your solo career. What were your first album? Was that were you on Intense for that album, or was that a different record label?
Yeah, Intense is Frontline Records, but it's their, you know, it was their metal or rock, you know, division where they could put their efforts, not to confuse it up with, you know, the Amy Grants and the, you know, just the pop music at the time. So yeah, it was on Intense, and most of my stuff was, most of the Rose stuff was.
How did that come together where you were able to officially do your solo stuff under the Rose name?
That was wonderful. So all that music was written because, and I'll kind of tell this, should I tell that, or should I tell the influence that got me into Rose? Well, I mean,
everything you want.
Okay.
I'm sure everyone's interested
in any which way it comes. Okay. Well, first of all, you know, I was writing some heavy music. I was into the Mission UK, Sisters of Mercy. Like I mentioned, these are the secular bands I'm mentioning. I'm just saying for musical, not lyric. I just want to make that very clear. Totally against all the lyrics, but musically, you know, like the Cult. And then I discovered Danzig because that kind of just, it kind of wrecked me. It's like, wow. Because like, I sing like him. I sung like him before I knew even who he was, because he's kind of a combination of Jim Morrison and Ian Ashbury from the Cult. You know, I mean, I didn't even know the Misfits. I didn't know he was in the Misfits. So I never even got to hear that voice until I heard Danzig. And I was going, oh my word. It's like the music of the Cult with, yeah, you know, with Jim Morrison screaming with almost kind of a rockabilly twang to it too, you know. So it was wild. And I was just realizing when I heard the lyrics of the song, you know, and I've been a saved, spirit-filled Christian for a long, long time. And you probably understand this, and probably all the listeners have gone through this, where you've purchased and broken every CD you've ever owned in your life. I've done it a million times. You know, I've had collections of CDs of bands that I would love for musical influence. I just couldn't take it. Just snap it. Lord, I don't want this in my house, you know?
Yeah, fill in the conviction.
Yeah, exactly, you know?
Yeah, luckily, I've done that with a couple.
Luckily, my heart is seared over with sin, and it's okay now. I'm kidding. I'm joking. I just wanted to throw that out there. No, I'm kidding. But no, seriously, when I realized that I liked that kind of music and how wicked the message was, I just honestly felt like God was impressing on my heart to write something that was, you know, very, very heavily influenced by Danzig and the Cult, and not to be shy about it, because I kind of sung that way anyways. It was very, very easy for me to do. I was already writing this music, so it was more of a thing like I just wanted to provide an alternative. And then my brother Roger was so cool, because, you know, he, you know, I'd still be on the front line. He said, he just walked me in the door. He said, hey, as you know, Randy's been a big part of Mad at the World. You know, he has some solo stuff you're gonna want to check out. And we just sat down and listened to it, and they fell in love with it and signed me instantly. I mean, and it was just, once again, it was just the Lord, it's just God, obviously making all this happen, because you
Yeah.
know he gives us our heart's desire, stuff that we really can do like in our sleep, something that we're actually kind of born to do or whatever. And that's it. And to me, this is the other side note, and I don't want to waste too much of your time on this, but this is a big part about the whole Danzig and the dark music scene. From an early age, probably from maybe sixth, seventh grade on up, I had people come to me. They were always talking about seeing things, hearing things, seeing spirits, and having crazy things happen in their family. The kind of stuff where, you know, normal kids wouldn't come up and talk to stuff, talk, tell secrets like that to me. People all over the place, everywhere I go, would start coming to me for help. And I started, you know, listening to Bob Larson, who is a big deliverance minister, and I realized, you know, how Satan gets hooks into people and the roots of some of this stuff and where this stuff comes from. So I knew what spiritual warfare was. I knew the addiction of how Satan tries to hook himself into people and reel them in with lies and a false gospel, or the idea of power, you know, through darkness and Satan and stuff like that. So I mean, I was encountering people that were in the occult, I mean, in my early teens. So it kind of became a side ministry where, you know, people at a party I'd go to. I've been to one party in my life, and it was I'm not a party type person, but I went with a friend, and I was just outside, and he came out, and he was a Christian, but he told me that he used to have blackout rages where he's in San Francisco, and he was into the occult, and he would black out, and he'd beat people up, and he would feel like nothing happened, lose all this time, and have a bloody fest, and realize he'd beaten bums up and stuff. And I prayed for him right there, and you know, spirit of rage and death and murder came out of him, and you know, and it was only Jesus. It has nothing to do with me. It's just the authority of God, you know. But it's just recognizing that. So I recognized at an early age, if I like this kind of music, there's Christians that like this kind of music, and I just wanted to give an alternative to it. That was the whole. I mean, that's the whole principle, even really, of you know, even undercover the Christian music scene. Anyways, Christian rock was to be an alternative, you know. And I know people don't like to say, well, you know, what is Christian music? Well, you know, isn't all music from God? Yeah, it is. But I mean, some stuff can be dedicated to God. Some stuff can be dedicated to darkness. It still came from God. But man, whoever you use it for has a lot to do with the lyrical intention about what's behind it, you know. So that's what drove me, you know, to write, you know, kind of an opposing album to like Danzig One. Matter of fact, it was reviewed in a satanic magazine, you know, Danzig versus Rose, you know, by
Really?
Randy Rose. Yeah, I mean, it was an honor to me. I back at Tower Records, when that was a big record store, you know, they had all the magazines. And they had this scary, creepy magazine called The Third Path. And it was a satanic magazine where you could order animals to sacrifice. I mean, just literally,
Wow.
it was
That's
totally, you know, I mean,
crazy. I did
yeah,
not know
crazy.
that. Never
Oh,
heard that.
absolutely. Oh, yeah, you don't want to hear about it. I think it's gone now, I hope. Lord,
Yeah, I hope so.
hope it to be gone. But anyways, on there, you know, the guy reviewed my album and said, man, you know, he was a Satanist. Said, man, music is awesome. Totally. If you like Danzig, you're gonna love this, but I can't stand this guy's lyrics. You know, but I gotta
Right.
tell you. You know, if you can black out the Jesus out of all this garbage, you'll love the music. It was an honor to me, because it's
Well,
exactly
what's funny is
where
that,
I
I
wanted
mean,
to
maybe
be,
the
you
guy
know.
didn't realize it, but maybe he was opening doors for Satanists to listen to your music, and it could
He
have
was.
changed their life by
I
listening
believe
to
that.
those lyrics he didn't enjoy. I mean,
Yeah.
yeah, that could have been, hopefully that's why that happened.
I think God used it that way. I do. So that was, you know, that's the whole kind of backstory, the inspiration of writing my own music that was heavier and darker. And then Roger literally just walked me through the door, and being a cool brother, he just helped me, you know, present it. And I got signed, and I did the record completely myself in my own studio, which is wonderful. Me and Roger did it. Roger was on as a producer. That was one thing he said, which kind of gave frontline a little security, because I was still young, you know, relatively young. I mean, not a kid, but young. But you know, if you have someone that's been, you know, signed to you for 3 or 4 or 5 years, said, hey, you already heard my brother's work. I'm vouching for it. I'll go ahead and produce it. And producing it means we just did it at his studio. But you know, still, I played every instrument. He played some guitar. I had Brent play lead. My brother Ray, my oldest brother, I was talking about, he's the one who played bass on that record.
Okay. I didn't know that. That's
Yeah,
interesting.
yeah. So it was all a family affair. It truly was Rose. It said Randy Rose, but it was truly Rose. It was all Rose, you know, except for Brent Gordon played leads, which is from Mad at the World.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's how that came apart, came to pass.
Yeah, you said you're not, I'm not sure what year that was. Early two, I mean 90s, not
Man,
2000s, but 90s.
I'm so bad with the years. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, you know, it's I know you guys do you are you, I know I think I saw this with Matt the World. You guys don't own any of that material. You don't have any rights to it. Is that right? Is that the same with your solo stuff too back from then or
most of it, like for instance, Sacrificium, which is Randy Rose's first release. Well, what it is Adele from FMG, I think it might have been a partner with Joey Taylor one time. They have a label where they're re-releasing all the Frontline stuff. I don't know if you've seen that. Have you seen that stuff? And they basically kind of do like greatest hits, like a combination of two albums in one and release it.
Yeah.
They're real sweet. They still send royalties. I still get royalties from it. But yes, they own those first three albums of Rose. But what they don't own is Into the Unknown, which I am going to re-release on the new label that I'm affiliating with.
Which was that?
That was the one that was on REX Records. That was the one, you know, the label in Nashville, right. but that label crashed.
I think that might be the one I had back in the day.
It had a bunch of like thorns on it.
Yeah, it was Rose in red, like in the lettering red.
Yeah, yeah. And like red and green, and then it had thorny rose, you know, things on the front of it. It actually looked like a typo negative cover. I didn't realize that. I mean, I didn't do it. I didn't do the artwork, but it literally looks like one of their covers.
Well, I was going to ask you, why was the one Sacrificium? How are you going to Sacrificium?
Sacrificium,
Sacrificium. Of course, I'm way off.
That's okay.
Was that different than Rose? Because it's under Randy Rose. I mean, was there a difference for that album?
Well, the funny thing is I'm back to Randy Rose now with the new label, which is crazy. It's funny. It's interesting how we do it. Initially, basically, Sacrificium was Randy Rose because it was a solo album. It was literally just an artist, you know, like it came out the same time as Mortal did. We actually did a photo shoot in Corona Del Mar the same day. So I know our stuff was being released. That's when I met Gyro for the first time and whatnot, you know. So it was released around the same time. And it was Randy Rose because I was the only recognizable promotable name. You know, Rose wouldn't probably have meant anything, but they did know me as Randy Rose from Out of the World. I mean, you know, fans did.
Yeah.
So it was a nice continuum to be able to say, hey, remember that
guy? So
it was
just kind of to help so people could associate, we know who this is.
I didn't ask for new person. All that. And I think, and I don't even, to be honest with you, I wish I even had my catalog in front of me to tell you this. I don't know when it even switched to Rose. Was it, I think Healing was Rose, I know, right?
Yeah, and what stinks, because I was kind of asking about the ownership and the rights, but you know, a lot of people do streaming now, or the Bandcamp stuff too, but with streaming, I mean, pretty much all the Out of the World stuff's on there, but the only bad thing is the Randy Rose, that album that we were just talking about, that's the only one on streaming that I could find, which, you know, kind of, I mean, it's good also because the person, okay, you need to go buy the stuff. I mean, if it hopefully supports you, but I mean, if it's under someone else, I mean, either way, but you still get royalties. So that's good. But you know, with everyone doing streaming now, it kind of, I wish all that stuff were on stream. Your solo stuff were on there. So it was a little more easy to access and listen to instead of, you know, having to go the old school way or popping a cassette tape like I might have.
No, I agree. Matter of fact, there was such a shortage, you know, for a while, like on some of the Rose and Mad of the World stuff, you know, stuff, some of the CDs were selling on eBay for ridiculous amounts of money. I mean, if I had any, I would have sold everything I had and seriously made some serious money. But, you know, I mean, I don't even own more than a handful of the product myself, literally anymore. I mean, I have some of the old t-shirts I just found that my mom was saving, you know, they're all passed away now, but she had boxes of old Mad of the World shirts, which is real cool.
Oh,
don't tell
cool.
Roger. Because he doesn't know. Never mind. Yeah. He's probably hearing this. So,
hey Roger.
Yeah.
Hey Roger. If you want to come on the podcast, you're welcome too. If you're in between delivering mail,
I'm sure you'd love to. Sure
Yeah, that's interesting. But you know, I'm kind of wondering, you're young, obviously, during that time. But you know, how is your life kind of progressing personally with music? You have your solo stuff, Math World. It's kind of Matt, the World's kind of coming to an end with Dreamland Cafe, correct? Was that the?
Well,
I know you came back later, but.
Well, we came back to do Hope, which was about probably three or four years ago.
Yeah.
And that that is the rebirth of us starting out to do another transition to Mad at the World. So yes, there is going to be another Mad at the World album. And what
Okay,
we're doing,
cool.
yeah, and you're kind of the, some of the Kickstarter people, they do know this, but I'm officially announcing it to you and everybody that hears my voice. There's going to be another Mad at the World album, and it's going to be the transition. We're doing three albums. The first one was kind of honoring all the synth pop stuff and that kind of transition. We're moving on to more of a of an alternative rock type thing, a little bit of heavy, a little bit not, you know, kind of honoring the middle years, kind of the stuff that you're, you know, that you're familiar with. That's going to be kind of what the next album is going to be about. Of course, it's going to be all new material, but we're kind of trying to honor that era. We're kind of replicating what we did from the start in a three.
Well, that
three
that, album. That definitely answers a question I was going to have about Hope that came out 2017, I believe. And you guys went to more of that poppy sound for that album. And I was going to ask you why that was, but now you kind of clarified the reason for that. And man, that's awesome that you guys are going to plan on doing another album. And I mean, that is there any timetable for that? Or is it just kind of, because you said it's a Kickstarter thing, it kind of just depends on donations, money coming in, things like that, time.
No, there's a time frame in my mind, because now, and obviously this is kind of a very now story. So I don't I'm kind of having to jump back and go back a little bit, but you know, since my father passed, we moved from Texas now to the high desert. We've been here for 1 week. So that's why back there looks like just a mess or a ghost town here. And we're just trying to make it work and stuff. But I moved all my recording studio stuff down here. Since the move, and since my father passing, I am going to be doing music full time. This is all I do. So I'll be talking to you, and I'm going to be doing music for a new record label that I'm associated with. I don't want to give too much of it away, because I don't even know if I'm even allowed to. But I mean, there's a lot of that there's a lot of that record already done. And if you like the first row stuff, you're going to absolutely adore the new Randy Rose stuff. I'm not even talking about The Masquerade, which
I was about to ask you The Masquerade.
I love that's my absolute favorite album I've ever done. But you know, that was a 4-year nightmare in the making. I've had everything, and that's a whole separate story. So I don't even want to go there until you're ready for that one.
Well, I mean,
it's a big one, you know.
I'll ask about that because I do want to mention it. But The Masquerade, because you just kind of mentioned something there that I was not aware of. But I guess it is the guy that's your. It's a new record label, technically, correct?
Yes,
that you're part of. Are you allowed to say the name of it, or is that okay?
Yeah, Behold Industries.
Behold, I know he contacted me on Facebook about setting up the interview, and of course I want to promote anything that he's putting out. So, and what I guess I assumed was that The Masquerade was part of that. So it's not actually The Masquerade that's going to be part of that record label. It's something that's not even been released yet.
Yeah. Well, actually, yes and yes. The Masquerade I chose because Josh Spencer, we got really, really close during this recording process. He was a longtime Mad at the World, especially Rose supporter. Mm-hmm. And we became really, really close friends. And he started this record label just literally during the later process of me recording this album. And he was a big supporter and a big part of a lot of the financial help on this Kickstarter album.
And Josh is the book, the
he's a CEO,
the Behold guy. Yeah. Basically Behold.
Behold Josh.
So anybody knows. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So anybody wondering who Josh is. Yeah.
He's the new Brandon Evil, put it that way. He's going to do it right. He's a great guy. So he was so supportive that this album was just going to be a Hindenburg Records release, which is my own label. That's what Songs We Ritually Abused. I did like 4 years ago, 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. That was under my label.
The one with Mark Martel I was mentioning earlier.
With Mark Martel, that's my second favorite album I've ever done.
You'll have to tell me about him after you're done telling this story, because he's amazing.
Yeah, he is absolutely amazing. Love him too. So, I got freaked out.
You were talking about The Masquerade and the new material that you eventually are coming out with Behold and how Masquerade's kind of tied in with also with Behold and Josh.
So I decided, instead of releasing on a Hindenburg Records like I did Hope and like I did Songs Originally Abused, instead of releasing on my own independent label, he was starting late. This is what he really one of the many things that he really wanted to do, and he could do it awesome. So I literally said, here's this album. I want this to be your first album. Because he was already talking about me being an artist, which is awesome. I was just honored to be that. So I had this album, 98% done. Finally, after four nightmare years, was like I said, a big story. I wanted to give that to him. I said, this, you like this album. You've been such an awesome support. Let this be a Kickstarter for your label, So it's under Behold. But what I'm talking about, as soon as I finished that, what I've been on working vigorously at my other studio before I moved it out to the High Desert studio here, is a new Randy Rose album. It's going to be on that label, which is another whole dimension of, rock and roll.
How would you put it musically, the sound? That is it, the typical kind of stuff that you've done in the past? Because the Masquerade kind of reminds me of the original stuff you did solo wise, from what I've heard, because I haven't been able, I know some of it's on Bandcamp, and on iTunes, the store, I know it said June 30th is the
30th,
official release
when the
date for
CDs
it.
are
So some of the
available.
song, I've heard those ones. But what I've heard, though, it kind of reminds me of the old stuff. I don't know. I could be incorrect on that.
No,
But
oh no, you're right.
so comparing that to what you're about to do, is there any kind of musical difference, would you say?
I'll paint the picture of the Masquerade and kind of how I see it, and I'll paint the picture of what I'm also doing, so you guys can kind of get the difference of it. The Masquerade is a barrage of the heaviest, like, stoner riff stuff that I could do, the Black Sabbath kind of stuff, Queens of the Stone Age kind of riffs, that kind of stuff, a real dry, slushy desert rock type of sound. But I also incorporated, melodies over it. I mean, it's actually like there's hummable melodies on it, which I really like. And I kind of do that by honoring like some of the glam 70s bands like Sweet. They had like those real thick
Yeah.
harmonies, or like
Great bands.
Queen, like Queen, Sweet, a lot of that kind of stuff, where the pop music of the 70s was actually really edgy and cool. It had great songwriting, serious songwriting, rock and roll, but it had killer harmonies. So it sounded like a real huge band. That's what I love about Queen. Like, Queen is probably like my all-time favorite band.
Mine too.
But I love them. So Queen and Sweet, dancing, stoner rock, that's all the Masquerade. I went as
Yeah.
heavy and slushy as I hard as
People
I
need to
could.
listen to it, and they get kind of their thoughts on it, I guess.
Definitely. And the whole thing about the Masquerade, there's more than meets the eye on it, because there's nine songs to the Masquerade, but there's another 15 songs on the Masquerade rarities, sessions,
Yeah,
Masquerade
saw
sessions,
that.
rarity demos and rarities. So there's five other songs that actually are part of the original album. One of them,
Okay, so that's
my
okay.
daughter sings on, and a couple of them literally could have been off the first Rose album. I mean, Randy Rose album. They're that kind of
Yeah.
Danzig, very, very good, like core. If you like my old stuff, you'd love that kind of stuff. So that's separate. That's a whole separate release, and then it has nine demo songs on it from the
How did you decide to break that up from the actual release and what was going to be just demos and rarities to release also?
Well, I had help with a record label on that. We felt that it was really important for the core of the album to have this certain style to it, presenting itself as this cohesive unit. And then we knew that people had to wait so long for my Kickstarter thing. And like I said, that's a whole separate story.
Yeah,
I'll tell that anytime you're ready for it, if I have enough tissues to get through it. I'm kidding.
Oh gosh.
Okay. Life support really is more like what I need for it. I'm kidding. But anyway,
It's out, thank God.
yeah,
It
it is
finally
out.
happened, at least.
Yeah, it finally happened, and that's the important part. But yeah, the reason for it is for cohesiveness. The second release that has the demos, I wanted to give these guys a bonus. I mentioned that, hey, if we get it past a certain
I got
milestone,
you.
I like to throw in a demos. But I mean, literally everything I had on demos on my DAT recorder blew up. I had one DAT recorder, a nice old SV3700, with one DAT tape of my demos, one lousy DAT tape of all of my old work, of like Rose live stuff. Real cool demo. I mean, like pre-healing, and Into the Unknown, actually, like a lot of songs. And there was a couple illegal cassettes floating out there that got out there somehow. I don't know how. I mean, I kind of know how, but I don't want to know how they got out there. But I found it on DAT, and I put it in my DAT machine, and it literally ate the whole thing up. So I'm at the end of this album, thinking, where and what on earth am I going to do? What in the world am I going to do? It's in my machine. So my record label helped get another SV-737 3700, which was kind of hard to find a good actual with low hours one that worked. I prayed like literally in the spirit, disassembled the other one, took the tape out. It was all messed up. Wound it up like, you know, like when a cassette tape blows up in an old car like it used to, you know, you have to
Yeah.
wrap it up with a
All the
thing.
stuff is all over the place. Yeah.
Oh yeah,
Grab hold
a
and
bunch of spaghetti in my lap. So
right.
the rest of my album was spaghetti in my lap, put it that way. So scary, so frightening, literally, because it was a promise. It was something that I said I was going to do.
Yeah.
And the way digital, and you probably know this, the way like digital audio tape works, it's super fragile. This stuff is like 25 years old. So it's only magnetic. You know, if you have a magnetic force, you sneeze on it. A spirit of Casper the Ghost runs by it, it deletes it. Seriously. I'm obviously being stupid, but
no,
it's super sensitive. So it was a miracle that I got it put together, put it in the DAT machine, and it was so dirty that it gunked up the heads on the new one. So I had to buy, you know, a cleaning thing for like $50. Something used to cost like $6. I had to get on eBay for some guy that actually still had a DAT cleaning cassette, cleaned it. I was able to get a run off of all the songs, quickly recorded them onto my computer, mastered them, and, you know, put it together as the bonus album. And we already knew we were going to put like the four or five songs for the masquerade on it. So it became another 15 songs, I believe.
So in a way, also, it's just a way to say thank you to everyone that kind of was patient.
Absolutely. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Even though you were having to be patient yourself, because it sounds like that was a lot of stressful. That reminds me. I kind of told you about, you know, recording with Steve Rowe, and I didn't record the first time, and I've recorded with guests. And it's always scary because I'll get done, hit stop, and I'm like, where's my recording? Why is my recording?
Oh my goodness!
I recorded with a guy one time. Who's the drummer for Tears for Fears, Jamie Wallum, used to play with Michael Sweet and all that stuff. But I got done recording, great conversation. It was gone. And I mean, I prayed. I'm like, I was so embarrassed I had to tell him too. I'm like, this recording's gone. I don't know if you'll ever have time to record again. And I tell you what, 4 days later, it magically just appeared on the computer. And I was like, I was stressing out. So I couldn't imagine, you know, with your actually having a whole album, pretty much just the stress of like, oh my gosh, I did all this for nothing, you know, in a way you're thinking.
Well, that was that, you know, and we are a little bit accidentally kind of transitioning into the masquerade and the nightmare that it was to do it. That was the whole entire way that whole album went. The whole entire album, I've never had so much opposition. I sold all my equipment to start this record and record it on an analog console. I got the recording desk, the same exact type that that Boston used for their first album.
Okay.
So I really wanted a vintage rock and roll sound. So I traded a lot of my digital equipment to go all analog into that. 2 weeks into that of recording this album, thing blew up. I had a guy come in just to do some repair work. Let's beef it up. Let's make it ready for this record. He beefed it up and he literally blew it up. And it was, I have pictures on Kickstarter saying, here's how my great start to my album is, you know, and it showed my mixer was just basically on fire. So, you know, this super expensive thing that I traded a bunch of equipment for became like a boat anchor. And till this day, I'm still getting it, you know, like fixed. I'm going to have a technician finally up here take a look at it. So I had to do so much reworking on this album, not to count. I just had.
It was just frustrating. Yeah. It's frustrating to do. I mean, yeah, like you said, your dad passed away, but go through personal stuff and then this. I mean, that had to be so frustrating, too, just to. You know, you've done something and you finished it. And you're like, now I got to redo it again, possibly, or something that you feel like should have been so easy and just done. You did the work and now all these issues popped up and you had to go through the ringer to get it where you wanted to hopefully be at.
Well, I feel like I've recorded this album, honestly, 2.5 times over. Because some of the first tracks that I did, and I have this on Facebook. I mean, it sounds like a joke, like literally like an excuse, except for I have proof of it. I'm talking through the cracked screen. The Mac that I did the very first few songs on got struck by lightning during a surge. And one of the daycare kids cracked my screen and literally I lost the first 3 or 4 songs I did of the masquerade already off the bat. So I had to re-record that too and had to replace, you know, the hard drive, and I can still never replace the screen, but it's good enough to see and stuff like that. But so I mean, everything that I had was like sabotaging this record. I mean, it was just physical health. I lost my mom and my dad and a whole bunch of friends. You know, it's just COVID. I was so unbelievably sick. I don't like to claim it for myself, but I've always been asthmatic and like allergic to everything that has fur and exists. You know, I'm surprised I can even be around people, but you know, I'm kidding.
I understand.
But, you know, Seriously, it was really bad. But I mean, I had what I would consider, an actual, couple different like heart attack failure type things when my health got really bad during the making of this record. I think a lot of it was just stress and pressure because, like, the one thing a lot of people that aren't artists realize is that we're kind of freaks. I mean, we were jesters and jugglers for the king, but outside that life, we needed to be in a little cocoon. We're fan. I'm kidding. I'm kind of. I'm not saying we're like not spoiled or weird. I'm just saying that to write from the heart, where your heart breaks when you write it, your heart can get broken very easy,
Yeah. Well, you're putting all your emotions out there for people to hear and see, I guess, too. So, let me go back a little bit too, because you mentioned something I wanted to ask you about. I know you have kids. You mentioned your daughter, and I know your daughter was part of one of your releases you did a while back too, wasn't
Song,
she?
she did a lot of backup vocals on songs for the Ritually Abused. And
Does she have her own stuff, or does she even
man,
kind of
you know
do anything
what?
with music?
She needs to be. She's all of my kids are so sickly talented. It just drives me crazy, actually. Because I mean, I have a recording facility. I know how to do this. I'm a
Yeah.
producer, engineer. I know how to do this stuff. My daughter could put Billie Eilish, in the toilet.
Really?
She's awesome. Noelle Rose is just awesome. She could
Yeah,
have
I remember
a
her and the
career.
stuff. It's been a while though.
She's awesome. She's a great voice. She's a songwriter. She plays acoustic guitar. There's no reason she should be working for Apple right now. She's incredible. And my son Randy Jr. is just the most prolific guitar player like that I know. He did a lot of work on songs that are usually abused and stuff, but he's really in the Beatles. Like when he learned music, he started with the hard stuff. He started like learning the real chords of Beatles. He blows me away on guitar, but I play all my guitar and the real stuff, but he's better than I am, better probably than I'll ever be. And my son Scotty is a ridiculous drummer. He's gonna be my live drummer. He's the
Oh,
only kid
cool.
I still he's the only kid I still have at home. So he's smart. He's saving his
Yeah.
money, staying at home, and he has a
I
big beautiful
totally get
Ludwig
it.
set, and he's gonna be playing the live shows for us. So look for Scotty Rose. He's gonna be my new drummer.
That's awesome that your family can be. I mean, you were involved first with your brothers and then now your kids. And that, I mean, that's really cool that you can bond that way.
Well,
My kids are young, and I hope they, it'd
oh,
be
they
cool to
will.
have the same way. You know,
Oh
I
no,
know.
they'll walk in your footsteps. They absolutely will. That's the way God wants it to be. And then the other big huge force in my life is my wife. Was my photographer and my videographer. So and she was my big inspiration in my lyrics. I mean, deep down inside, she had kind of a rough past. I'm not gonna, say the stuff that she's been through, but she's been the heart and soul of almost all of my lyrics. So I mean, literally, I will never be able to stop writing about how incredibly impressed and blown away I am with my wife. So
That's awesome.
my family is my family and Jesus is what I'm doing this for.
That's awesome. Well, I was gonna ask you, how old are you kids?
I forgot. No, I'm kidding.
No, it's
They
okay,
are
I think.
they're 22, 24, and 27, probably.
Okay.
Very good chance. That's where they should.
Around that time, or age,
They're
around that
around
time
that
frame.
span. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's the age they are in my mind, at least.
Yeah. I remember when my first was born and I had to go to the pharmacy and they're like, "What's his birthday?" And I'm like, "Hold up. I don't know." I had to think. I was like, "Oh crap, what is my kid's birthday? He was just
I
born like a
know.
while." I'm like, "Oh man, I don't think about it."
Yeah, I
Yeah,
get that.
I don't want to keep you too much longer, man. You've been awesome with your information and I want to respect your time.
No,
You know, but
I'm as long as you want to go, buddy. I'm
hey, well, don't put it past me because I know people out there, and maybe we'll have to do a part two, you know, eventually,
sure. I
especially
would love to.
once the newer stuff starts happening too. But I'm looking forward to the full Masquerade thing. But of course, I gotta go back to the whole Mark Martell thing. I don't know. I've talked M Mark. I don't know him, but I've known of him for quite a while before he really started getting even more famous. I guess right after the whole Ellen DeGeneres thing. Mark Martell was also in a band called Down Here. I believe it was Down Here, which was a Christian band. I guess I would say they're a Christian band,
Yeah, they were.
but Mark, you know, was crazy. He also is a big Keith Green fan, and he posted some cover songs of Keith Green because everyone knows him for doing Freddie Mercury stuff and all the Queen stuff. But I mean, the dude, man, I love to. I'm like, please post some more Keith Green songs because
I said the
that's
same thing. I saw the same YouTube
really.
video. Yeah. Do you see
Oh, I
all the
love it.
people sinking down? Yeah, it just breaks. That's one of my favorite songs. I mean, I love
Oh,
Keith.
yeah.
Yeah, matter of fact, that's one thing we had in common. I tell him I love Keith Green. He grew up on Keith Green too, and so did I.
Yeah. I didn't get in. You know, it's crazy about, I don't know, 8 years ago is when I kind of finally got into Keith Green. I've always known who he was. And I just finally, I don't know what it was. I started listening. I'm like, man, this is really, I really like this music. I like his lyrics. They're so bold and different, you know, for
They
especially
are.
back
They're
then. But
radical. It's
oh,
revival
yeah.
music. It's revival music,
Oh, yeah.
you
Yeah.
know.
Like, you know, you know, the what was the line that says, Jesus rose from the dead, but you can't even get out of
Get out of
bed.
your
Kind
bed.
of, I mean, that's, I'm like, hey, we've all been there. We've all been lazy. It's true, unfortunately. But, yeah, but going to Mark, yeah, how did you get hooked up with Mark Martell? I'm telling people you don't know who Mark Martell is, go on YouTube and just search in Mark Martell. And if you're a Queen fan, you'll be blown away how this guy, and he even worked with on the Freddie or the Queen movie, doing a lot of the
He did
recordings.
most of the
Right.
vocal stuff. He did all the singing on that. On the Queen movie. It was amazing. I found him initially through YouTube, and this was for the album Songs Seriously Abused. And I was initially going to that album kind of wanting to do even more of a Queen thing with a lot of backup vocals. That album actually had a ton of Queen backup vocals, but you know, like more than I've ever done. I wanted to incorporate this to make it sound like it was a 6-piece band where every member, like Jellyfish, could sing. You know, that was kind of my intention. And anything that was, you know, kind of Queen related, I wanted his voice on it. I actually have a recording of him of something that I didn't release, and I probably will release later, actually, if I
Yeah,
can
that'd be cool.
find the hard drive. But I just contacted him, and it was before he blew up so much. You know, like he's constantly on tour with
Oh,
a
yeah.
Queen Celebration or Queen
Yeah,
Experience,
Queen
whatever
Extravaganza, I think
extravaganza.
is
I
what he
think that's
does
what it.
now. I know he's doing some Queen thing, because I know he's also worked with, oh man, I'm going blank. There's another band, they always have a different singer, and they're real popular around here. But they'll do Pink Floyd stuff for a while, and then
Oh, really? Okay.
they'll do, but Mark has come through with them to do Queen stuff. I'm going blank. This is going to drive me crazy. But
Okay.
yeah, but how many songs did he actually sing on the album?
He sang the chorus of Songs Seriously Abused. He sang the intro to Songs Seriously Abused. He sang all the choruses on it, and he sang Kellen the Illustrator, one of the ballads, which is like one of the most beautiful tear-jerking songs ever. So he sang basically two songs, and there's another song that he sang like a chorus on, like I said, that I haven't released, and I'll probably dig that out and, you know, probably
Yeah.
need to get his permission again for it. I mean, I paid for it, so it's okay. But you
Yeah.
know, he basically almost did it for free just as another Christian brother, you know,
That's awesome.
kind of helping me out. But you know, the other guest, which was really cool to mention for anybody that was in the alternative movement of the 90s, is Ken Stringfellow and John R. from the Posies also sang on Songs for the Tributes. I don't know if you knew that.
No, I didn't.
Are you familiar with the Posies at
Yeah,
all?
I've heard. Yeah, I've never really were. Was something my band I got into, but I do know who they are.
They were a real big, you know, Seattle alternative band, you know,
Yeah.
and they did kind of, you know, the REM. Ken Stringfellow was in REM. Was one of the guitar players for a while, but he was a good friend. I actually used to build custom mics, and I sent one of him as an endorsee, so he kind of became a friend. So he sang a song on there. And then the singer of the Posies is John R.
Okay.
He also sang a song on there called The Girl. So that's kind of the album that has the most variation of vocals of anything. It's me, Ken Stringfellow, John R., and then a killer, killer, killer backup vocalist, Joe. I don't know if you know Joe Gidding. Have you heard him on the internet?
That name sounds really familiar.
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
he's kind of like Mark Martell, where he can like imitate everybody, but he does the thickest, most killer backup vocals, like Queen style. I mean, like almost
Yeah.
unmistakably Jellyfish Queen style. He did it for Songs Seriously Abused, and he also did it a little bit on this album. But my brother also did a lot of Queen vocals for my new album on the Masquerade
For the
Rock Tour.
Masquerade. Yeah, I saw
Yeah.
that. You know, I was gonna ask about that just a second, about your brother and his involvement with that, because I saw that in the liner notes for on Bandcamp. But the album with that we're just discussing, though, where can people get that at? Or is there like a or any of your music? Is there a certain website, or is it on Bandcamp? I know your Masquerade's on Bandcamp too, but
Songs Seriously Abused and The Masquerade are both on Bandcamp. They're both on iTunes to purchase. If you Google it right, say the right name, they're all Spotifyable too, but you got to put in the whole name because
yeah.
for some reason the Rose and Randy Rose mixes everything up, and it's kind of hard to find. And there's also Randy Rose info. That's my website.
Okay.
That can send you to a way to be able to, you know, purchase some of this stuff. But both of those albums are available on iTunes, and I believe even the Master 8 sessions after the 30th are going to be available. So I mean, there's a bunch of new stuff that a lot of people haven't heard, to kind of reintroduce myself into the world of music. Because like I said, I'm holding on to the Lord's shirt tails. I mean, on this one, this is about Jesus having to carry me, because this is a transition in my life where this needs to happen. And you know, I'm doing it independently, but I'm also doing it with the Behold, you know, records, which is great. So that's going to lead into finishing the record I said that I was going to do with Behold, which is kind of more honoring some of the early Rose stuff. And then after that, I'm going to take a tiny break. Not really, I'm going to take a break. Then I'm going to go into the Matt of the World album. That'll be a Kickstarter.
I'm looking forward to both of those, to be honest with you.
And I just need enough people to hear the Masquerade so my name is no longer in the dirt. I'm kidding. No, I mean, you know.
No, trust me, people will listen.
Yeah. A lot of people didn't understand, you know, what I was going through and facing during that record. Like, a lot of people like, man, I supported you. Where have you gone in 3 years? It's like, trust me, buddy.
They think you just took their money and like, well, I'm not doing anything. I'll do whatever I want now. You know, but realizing all the personal stuff you went through.
And
the recording stuff you went through.
It was a big deal. And I poured my heart into it. And that's what they deserved. You know, and they deserve the most honest. I mean, I'm pretty hard on myself on this record, but you know, the Lord gives us that freedom, you know, to say, Lord, I'm a wretch, but you're awesome. You know, you're good. You're holy. And I'm your mess. Thank you for loving this mess. And thank you for giving me these gifts, even though I'm a mess, you know, and that's what Jesus is about, man. And that's what that record is about. So like, my lyrics probably going to be the most weird, snarky lyrics I've ever written. They're totally Christian. There's God in there, you know. So, but they're real deep. They're real dark. They're real interesting. You gotta look at them and ask the Lord, you know, what part He wants someone to grab from it, because they're kind of wild.
You're not singing about sex is a wonderful thing.
No, you know, that's the thing. No, I sing about how unwonderful it isn't when someone abuses you. That's really that's a big theme. That's a real big
totally
theme
different
about
theme my here.
My ministry, and I know what you're saying, though. And that album was, that song was banned for a long time.
Yeah, I know there was some controversy with that song because people obviously don't listen to all the lyrics, I guess. And I know there was other meaning behind the song and the meaning for that song, I think I read too. So
there is
it's funny. I was listening to that the other day and I had my kids in the car. They were oblivious to it, but I was like, that song just got stuck in my head. I sing it the rest of the day, just that one chorus, you know,
that one line.
Just the one part that sticks out, chorus.
Just don't sing it out loud at the market, that's all.
Yeah,
you know.
too late
I know. Been there, done that.
But yeah, I also did want to say, because Roger was part of the Masquerade. Did he play a lot of the do guitars? Was that in background vocals and other stuff? Or
he did some background vocals, and he did all of the lead guitar on this record, except for one where I had Tristan Arden something or rather. He's the guitar player that Brian May chose for the Queen Experience. He's Mark.
Oh, right, the left-handed guy.
Yes. The guy that was on the actual American Idol show, you know, that did the lead, the real cool guy. He's a ridiculous guitar player. So he plays in one of the songs, and you can hear
it.
There's leads all through the whole song. I mean, it's literally one entire lead, the whole song, you know?
Yeah.
But Roger did all the other lead guitar. So
which song was that? I'm trying to look it up right now.
Is it Across the River? Do I have a song called that? I don't have it in front of me.
Track number 7, Across the River. I can't hear it yet, but
yeah. So Tristan, you know, was handpicked by Brian May to be his emulation in the Queen Extravaganza band, played lead guitar in that one song.
That's really cool.
And Roger played lead on the rest of it. And I just asked Roger. I told him exactly what style I wanted to do, and he just nailed it for me. I mean, it was great. He used to be just a rhythm guitar player, and then about 5 years ago, he said, you know, I'm going to sit down and force myself to play lead. You know, I have time. I'm going to try this discipline. And he actually did it, and he is incredible. So, yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah, and you kind of mentioned that, too, because I didn't really know him as a lead guitarist. And
yeah.
You're talking about this for now. So,
but the instrumentation of, you know, Songs Seriously Abused in the Masquerade is me on almost all, on the new albums, all me on rhythm guitar, me on all the bass, except for maybe one or two songs that Roger did. and Roger all on lead guitar, me all on drums, me all on vocals, and Roger on some of the backup vocals, and Joe Gidding on maybe two or three songs where you hear the, you know, clean backup style vocals. So that's the whole thing. It's very, a very close knit thing. Yeah, songs originally Beatles, there's a lot more people involved. My nephew played almost all the rhythm guitar actually on that. Young guy, he's really real good, heavy guitar player.
I want to mention, of course, another band you're involved with was Mothership. I didn't really touch on that, but you know, I don't know what you want to mention about Mothership, because it's been a while since I heard that the album, and I totally forgot about it, to be honest with you. I was doing the research. I'm like, yeah, man, I forgot about that band.
Yeah, that believe it or not, that particular one, if you're talking about the Mothership EP, if you're talking about that one, the one that was
just the Mothership. Everything you did Mothership as the band,
there's also the one that had the, you know, the kindergarten class had my face on it too, and that also was Mothership too. So there was one that was earlier that I recorded with Ronnie Martin. He was kind of the label person for BEC, which was branded
from Joy Electric.
From Joy Electric.
Yeah, my old band, we used to work with Ronnie. Ronnie kind of helped manage us a little bit back in the day.
What was your band?
Never heard of them. Pacifico. Was our name. I've mentioned it before, but we were kind of like a little bit poppy rock. I'll have to send something to you. We were close to getting signed with Tooth & Nail. Didn't happen. We used to Ronnie Martin. I know he was also with what was the other guy that was in Joy Electric with him that had the little record?
Jason
was
Martin.
It, was no, not his brother, but
you're talking about
had the little record label. Was it Velvet Blue or something like that?
Yeah, Velvet Blue Music.
Jeff. Yeah.
Cloud. What? Oh my goodness, I don't know why he's
Jeff Cloud. I think it is Jeff Cloud.
I think it's Cloud. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, all those people, it's kind of popping up me too as you're
those
mentioning.
Those are my friends. That's who I used to hang out with after high school. We had fans that came to all the Mad of the World shows, and we didn't even know them by name, but they're always in the guest list. Me and Roger put on, we called them the Three Blind Mice because there were three Gothic kids, and it was Ronnie, Jason Martin, and one of their buddies. That's how we met them.
Do you remember the band that they put out, Fine China?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That first album was so good. It kind of has a little bit of that early, maybe Mad of the World, but the pop kind of synth pop kind of stuff to it. Maybe they were
absolutely
possibly influenced by all that too, but all these memories are just popping in. I'm so ADD.
That's okay. I am too, man.
Going back to the Mothership stuff, you know, if anybody wants to check that stuff out, tell me, man, that was good from what I remember. I mean, what was your involvement in that? Was that really just your band under a different name, basically?
Yeah, it was completely all me. Yeah, I did it all in my studio, and it was kind of a, like, you remember the band Portishead in the 90s?
I think I do. I don't remember.
And it kind of girl singer, and it kind of sounded sounded like spy music. You know, it was real like alternative and dark and spy music. So they were kind of a big influence. So I started using drum loops and went back to some of my keyboards and did just kind of some ethereal, alternative, real dark, kind of interesting music. And that record was signed, you know, and Ronnie was kind of the overseer of that label of Tooth & Nail that did like electronica type stuff. So that was one record released to them. But then independently, I did another Mothership album, which I like even a lot better. And it's very much along the lines of like Owsley, the band Owsley, or like Jellyfish or Phantom Planet, if you're familiar with Phantom Planet.
Oh, yeah.
Some of the early alternative stuff, you know. And that was, Rockstar. That's the name of that album. That's one you need to look for. Actually, I have that. So if anybody wants to personally write me, I have the only copies you'll find of that CD called Rockstar. I still got probably.
Was that ever put out on streaming? I feel like I heard it on streaming a long time ago.
You know, I think everybody.
One of the Mothership albums.
Everything's playing in Russia illegally right now. Sure.
You can probably go to YouTube and find it.
Yeah, I think someone probably has put it up there, but I legitimately, I don't know if it is, but it should be. I want all my stuff compiled to one catalog where someone could find all my stuff. That's my goal to do with Behold Records. I want somehow to be able to get this stuff together, maybe even re-release, maybe even buy some of the rights back and re-record some of the albums. I know I'm going to re-record Into the Unknown. I know that. That's one thing I am definitely going to do. And that's going to be, you know, within the next year and a half too.
That way you could have the rights to that material just updated.
Yeah.
We've covered quite a bit, and man, I guess the one the other thing, of course, I keep saying wrapping it up, but I wanted to ask about was with the Mad at the World stuff. Do you, I know you've had different members during the time. You know, you mentioned a couple of those guys. Do you still have any contact with them? Will they be involved with the new material at all, or is that just going to be mainly you and Roger doing the new, the second Mad at the World, rock album?
Yeah, what it will be is we're going to more than likely split the writing right down the middle, me and Roger. So, you know, it'll still be a relatively, you know, cohesive style. They'll work together, but we're definitely going to write half the album. He's going to write half the album. And then we're going to also sing on each other's stuff. And then we're going to incorporate Ben Jacobs, who is one of the original guitar players from Rose. Because Rose formulated a live band. That's where the break. Actually, I should have said that earlier. When we started calling it Rose, we were a live band at that point. That's the one, like that Win a Day with Randy Rose. I actually still had that band, but I started calling it Rose because it was silly just calling it myself when there's four other guys on stage or whatever, you know. So Ben Jacobs will be joining us. We probably will have Mike Link, which is one of our old bass players, play on it too. We're going to try to incorporate it to kind of historically capture that sound. So we're going to try to get as many of the people, you know, that recorded in Mad at the World on it as possible. But all the writing will be me and Roger. All the recording and engineering will be me and Roger. And I know I'll do the mastering because that's one of my things I do well.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. If there's something that I didn't hit on that you want to mention, you know, feel free to. I don't know. Hopefully we covered quite a bit of it. I mean, I'm glad you're a talker because trust me, that makes things so much interesting. Oh, and man, it's been awesome talking to you, learning. I've learned
That's
a lot.
Awesome.
And
Thank you.
I think, I think people are really going to enjoy this episode as long as it actually recorded.
Yeah.
I'm
redo
scared
it.
Now. Yeah. Repeat everything you just said.
Redo. Yeah.
But anything that we didn't mention or any projects that I didn't hit on that you wanted to put out there that I may have forgotten about?
Well, I just wanted to encourage everybody to, you know, get back into supporting the Christian music scene. You know, it's been so, you know, classy and socially appropriate to, you know, kind of poop on the Christian music scene, you know, like it's just some little tiny insignificant remnant, but you know what? It needs to come back. There's a revival of that coming along, and there's going to be someone else replacing us if we don't do it. I'm still young enough to do this. I want to do this. So I mean, I just encourage people, just youth groups, you know, start having bands play again, open the churches for concerts. And then, I mean, that's not where we need to be, but I mean, it's a good kindling place. We got to start somewhere again. You know, I want it to start again. So I'm going to start touring again for the first time in, man, 25 years.
What material are you going to do? Just
all of my Rose stuff. Yeah.
That's
all
awesome.
Of my Rose stuff from day one. From day one of Sacrificium to the Masquerade to the new stuff that's going to be coming out. So I have quite a library. And, you know, now I'm back in California. So, you know, Ben Jacobs is my guitar player. He's like 35 miles away from me. So I got that. And I got a drummer. So, you know, God's going to provide who I need, you know, to do it. But the main thing is just, you know, support Christian music. You know, we're not a remnant. It's not just a thing of a past. The Lord still wants to move big time on this. I mean, more than ever. I mean, honestly, you know, and it's okay to be rebellious, and it's okay to stand up against stuff that's like, you know, deemed inappropriate. I mean, on Facebook, you know, everything gets censored now. It's kind of sad. You know, it's ridiculous that you know, being safe, you know, means we're a radical or whatever. That's just not the way it's supposed to be, man. You know, we're set aside for God's purpose, but you know. We can turn over tables. Jesus did it, you know, and that's what I do with my music. It's what I try to do. I mean, it's not even mine. It's all God's music. So that's my thing, you know, but I would definitely love for people to check out, you know, Songs from the Richly Abused and the new one, The Masquerade, Bandcamp or wherever you can find it. Just to know that, you know, we're still here, you know, we're all still here. You're here. I appreciate so much what you're doing. I mean, you're keeping a candle burning, man. I mean, that's what this is about, you know?